This week on Reality Check on KCIW, we are exploring water and watersheds with Ann Schmierer, Executive Director of Wild Rivers Land Trust. This is Lee Tooley, and I have with me today Ann. She's not only the Executive Director of the Land Trust, but a lifelong outdoorsman. And I wanted to talk about water today because I realize, as someone who considers themselves relatively self-informed, I find myself at a huge loss when it comes to water and the issues that affect us in this area. I remember going to school and hearing about the water cycle and how dependent we all are on water for life itself, but it pretty much ends there. So I was thinking maybe to start us off, maybe looking at the international issues. I know that desertification, climate change, and deforestation are a lot of issues that impact water a lot. I wonder, Ann, if you could start us off by just maybe unpacking that a little bit for us.
Yeah, one of the challenges that we have globally is that the planet is warming. We can probably argue why that's happening, but it is a fact that poles are melting, and we have rising sea levels around the globe. This can affect particularly low-lying areas around the world, but also affects us here at home in our estuaries and low-lying areas, and how it affects the weather in general, how we may have more violent weather in some places than others, and it's concerning. You see in the Gulf Coast, you know, increased hurricane strength, and Houston was, you know, a really tragic story last year. So we're coming into hurricane season again. Hopefully we'll have a mild one, but I think this is just one of the areas that rising temperatures around the globe are going to affect us everywhere.
I know I was doing a little bit of reading about some of the statistics that are out there, and I was just completely shocked that I read everything from 800 and something million to 1.6 billion people don't have access to safe water, and that because of that, there's a huge amount of disease that's waterborne affecting a lot of developing countries, to the point where 1.8 million kids, I was reading, just from dysentery alone, die each year. It's pretty shocking. And on the other hand, women spend, because they're usually the water gatherers, in some developing countries may spend as much as 36 hours a week carrying water. And those water jugs can be 44 pounds or more. So I hear that even nationally, by the year 2025, we might be two-thirds of us at risk for water scarcity.
Yeah, well, you know, you can look around the globe, but we don't have to look far in the United States to look at how fragile our water systems are. You can look at Flint, Michigan, you know, which is a pollution-related issue with lead in the water, which is an infrastructure problem, to the, you know, what's happening in California. There used to be this fabulous agricultural area that is now they're pumping water out of the aquifer at alarming rates because they're not getting the rainfall. And there are water rationing issues there. And it's the scarcity of water, particularly in the southwestern part of the United States, is kind of migrating north. There's also something called the 100th meridian, which used to be the longitudinal line in the United States where agriculture could exist without irrigation, I guess. It's sort of the desert meets agricultural land. And that has migrated, I believe, 100 miles east. I'm not sure on the exact mileage, but it's the arid area is expanding and it's moving east into parts nearing Iowa and places like that. So Kansas, Nebraska are having more water issues as time goes by, and the farmers there and ranchers are suffering.
So it sounds like desertification isn't just something that happens in in developing countries, but here too.
Correct.
And before we get on too much about the national scene, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about internationally, and that was something I remember hearing about quite a few years ago now, but there was a lot of riots and upheaval about having to pay for water. And I believe it was in South America. Do you recall the story I'm trying to reach for here?
That doesn't ring a bell, but I think that a lot of people have predicted that water is essential for life. That's one thing that we just can't live without, because it's the basis of, you know, I don't know what percentage of water content we are, but it's pretty high. And we require food, which requires water. So it really sits at the very bottom element of our existence. And if it's not managed well, or if it's, or if it becomes scarce, we very well could have, you know, wars, I guess, over water at some point. I don't know. It's, you know, with the rising sea levels, a lot of the population is concentrated on the coasts, which may have, you know, profound effects on cities. The eastern seaboard is pretty, you know, low-lying and will be impacted probably greatly by rising sea levels. It is already. In Florida is a classic example.
I remember when I lived in Canada, there was talk of having a pipeline from Canada to Los Angeles just to supply LA with water. And I know there's a lot of fuss over the Imperial Valley down there, Mono Lake going away, Colorado River. I understand by the time it gets to Mexico, it doesn't exist anymore.
Correct.
these are just things that have already happened, right?
Right.
And everybody is sort of outgrowing the systems that have been in place. Another thing I was reading about is that our water infrastructure seems to be over 100 years old, which is well beyond its shelf life. And it was something like we need $1 trillion in order to replace it.
Yeah, yeah. So this you know, is Flint, Michigan's probably, you know, classic example of the pipes are, you know, were poorly constructed in the first place. They still don't have clean water. I mean,
Even now. Been 2 years?
I think it's more getting on like 5 years.
Really?
Gosh. Yeah. So it's kind of crazy, but the infrastructure for a lot of these systems is aging. One of the things that is concerning in our part of the world are tide gates. North of us are a number of rivers like the Coquille River and the Coos watershed that have tide gates that keep salt water out of areas and kind of help control water flow in these tidally influenced areas. And a lot of them are failing. And the infrastructure is over 50 years old. It's antiquated, it's, you know, breaking down, it's just fundamentally failing and not able to work. So this is a classic example of probably hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, replace all of the tide gates in Oregon.
Yeah.
And we're really, everyone's struggling to understand, you know, how that's going to happen, because people's livelihoods for farming and ranching depend on those tide gates.
Yeah, well, we have a problem here, I think, in harbor when the river goes really low, that we get that intrusion of salt into the drinking supply.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. So you start pulling on that well, and it creates sort of a backflow from the salt water into the fresh water, you know, from the well deep underneath us, and it will, yeah.
We're getting a little ahead of our story and getting into the local things, but is there anything about that on the table anywhere to manage that situation in some way?
With the tide gates?
Yeah, well, with harbor in specific.
That I don't know.
Okay.
I just know that there is a problem with the water quality, and I, you know, I'm not sure what the city has planned for solving that.
Even for Brookings, is that right? Water quality in Brookings
as
well?
Yeah, I mean, with the salt incursion into the drinking water. Yeah.
Okay, so I have dumb question time. I love to always have at least one dumb question. All right, here it is. I have camped out and gone backpacking a lot, and the word is always never drink water out of a stream because it's got giardia in it and all of that. But then the streams end up in the river, and then we drink our water, our city water comes out of the river. But we don't have to worry about giardia there?
Yeah, it's treated. So typically there will be, filtration, and then probably, I think probably what's most commonly used is chlorine treatment.
Is that what we have here?
I don't know for certain, but
Do we fluoridate?
I don't know if you fluoridate, but chlorinate would kill cooties.
Cooties?
Yeah.
Get rid of those cooties. Okay. So, do we have a scarcity problem here in Curry County or the surrounding areas? I mean, we've had a drought, and some places ran out of water in their wells and so forth.
Yeah.
Do you know much about that?
One of the things that with changing weather patterns is how, our aquifers are recharged every year. It's not always clear, where water flows from. It can flow, through a crack from miles away. And earthquakes can disrupt these types of water flow patterns underground into aquifers.
In terms of recharging the aquifers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
So as less water, as we have drier summers and more people moving to the area, there's a greater demand for water. And, these systems can be fragile. I know that when I was living in Corvallis a few years ago, we had a very dry summer, and the reservoir got so low, the water was actually undrinkable. It tasted so awful. It had some type of algae growing in it.
Ooh.
And it didn't matter if you had a water pitcher filter or anything. I just went to, buying, containers of water just to drink from. But this is going to become more common as, our areas become more populated and you have more pull and more use of water. The Central Valley in California is a classic example where...
Oh, what's that about?
Well, they've, with all of the drier weather and the drier weather patterns and less rain, they're pulling enormous amounts of water from underground aquifers and they're getting depleted. They're using water for agriculture, and they're rationing water for showers, for individual home use, watering lawns and things like that. One of the challenges with, say, the almond industry in California is that for every almond that you eat, it takes a gallon of water to produce that almond. So
that's a lot of gallons of water.
So these people have, sort of this fixed asset. You can't move your almond trees. So you do the best you can with pulling water from underground aquifers. And they're finding that these are not being recharged and they're being depleted.
I noticed that in the last few years, the prices of some of these nut meats have gone through the roof. I wonder if it's because of the water scarcity causing the price of, maintaining those orchards to go up.
Could be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about the Central Valley, but also the Great Plains is all fed by the Ogallala, I believe it's called, aquifer, and that one is supposedly getting very depleted too. And those two areas are huge breadbaskets, not just for us, but the whole world even.
They are. And these are areas where we've kind of taken for granted that there will always be water. But, as we use these fresh water supplies, there's not really anything to fill that back up. And there's countries like Israel are using desalination types of technology. So there, for some places, there could be a technology fix, but that's extraordinarily expensive and very energy intensive. So like I said, the demands on water globally, fresh water, clean fresh water, drinking water, is going to become more pressing as we go forward.
Somewhere I read also that only about 70% of the fresh water is actually clean at this point. There's so much pollution. So many places in the world where everything just gets dumped into the rivers and streams.
Yeah. Yeah, that used to be the mantra used to be the solution to pollution is dilution. But I think everybody understands now that it all comes back to haunt us in the end, that, you know, you keep dumping things into the rivers and into the ocean, and you're going to have serious consequences.
Well, I know, like on the ocean, they say that the fisheries along the coast here are just pretty much dead. I've seen maps of that, and that's, I suppose, pollution-driven.
Yeah, there's. It's actually very complex. It's also ocean current-driven. It's if you don't have adequate mixing in the ocean, you'll get dead zones where there's not enough oxygen, and you need that kind of mixing, and our weather patterns are changing, and because the weather patterns are changing, the ocean currents are also changing, and this sort of recycling that's done, especially along our coastlines, is changing as well. So there's a lot in flux right now.
And back to this idea of pollution, I mean, obviously there's filter systems for normal pollution, but when you start talking about heavy duty things like the real chemical toxic stuff, the heavy metal stuff, can you reclaim that water very easily? Is that possible, or is it what happens to it?
There's only so many things you can remove from water. You know, they find even in large water supplies in cities that they're finding really high levels of certain types of medications.
Oh yeah, antibiotics and all of that.
Antibiotics,
hormones,
and antidepressants, and they found in certain ecosystems where this water is discharged is that they're finding it in amphibians and other types of very susceptible populations of organisms that, it's altering their biology. So, you know, thinking about purifying water, once it gets into the water, it's very difficult to take things out of it.
Yeah.
There's only so much, you can filter things out, but that's more particulates. For removing other types of dissolved pollutants, you need to use different types of, separation technologies or columns that pull certain things out. But those get very expensive, and they need to be replaced pretty
quickly. So, I mean, going back to the fifth grade water cycle lesson, as I recall, everything gets evaporated out of the ocean. So those pollutants don't get evaporated back into the cycle, I suppose.
They can. Yeah.
Oh, really? Well, that's really disturbing.
Yeah. A well-documented thing that we have here is, when they do the aerial spraying on the coast for removing the herbicides to remove vegetation in some of the forested areas that they want to replant or promote tree growth, they're finding that a lot of this will evaporate up into the fog and will be carried, very distant from other areas. So just the fact that these things can be carried in fog and clouds doesn't mean that they're it's pure. They found that I can't remember how many billions of viruses fall from the sky every day, and they're benign viruses, but they're there's something that came out recently in the scientific literature that we have a lot of things that fall out of the sky, bacteria, and they're actually involved in seeding clouds and things like that. So they do beneficial things. They're little tiny particulate matter. Mm-hmm. They just happen to be
living.
They
get swept up by the wind and
and they get
back
carried.
On us.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, interesting. Really interesting. So let's see. Around here, do we have a lot of pollution problems?
I would say that there are sort of point source places, you know, like I mentioned, that the aerial spraying can be an issue and that getting into our water systems. But unfortunately, a lot of people, they still dump things into rivers. Mm-hmm. And when you walk around in a city like Portland, you'll see those places on the sidewalk that said it has like a picture of a fish, and it's like, don't dump your, you know, toxic things down this drain because it will go into a river. Cities, runoff from parking lots and, and roads can also be, contribute to water pollution as well.
And as I recall, there's some conflict about dredge mining around here as being a pollutant to the rivers. Is that?
The mining industry, historically, I'm not sure how they handle it now, especially on the rivers, but they used to use mercury to extract gold from the, I've talked to some miners, and they're actually very helpful in a lot of ways, because if they find a pocket of mercury that is buried in a gravel bar, I guess, they will, pick it up and clean it up and be helpful that way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of these types of chemicals that were used, at the turn of the century and even after that, that still are providing.
You mean the century before this one or this one?
The century before this one,
okay,
yeah. So I'll just say, the last 100 and 150 years of European habitation has brought some of these less than desirable, practices, and we're still kind of having to clean up that now.
And it's so easy to just think, if I flush this down the toilet or down the drain, it's gone.
Right. And that's where a lot of the drugs get into the water systems. Mm-hmm. Is that a lot of people have been told to flush medications down the toilet to get rid of them, but they're actually asking people to find drop-off places where these medications can be disposed of in a more ecologically friendly way, because it's they don't want you to necessarily put them in the garbage. Or have them get into hands that, it might not be a good idea, children
hard to know what to do with them.
So that's where the advent of, check around, see where you can find proper disposal of medications around. So, yeah.
So let's see, we were talking about reclaiming water that's been polluted. What about just scarcity in general? We mentioned desalinization plants. Are there other ways that water is being maximized, solutions to some of these things of scarcity?
Probably the best thing is reducing how much water you use to begin with.
Forget the golf course, huh?
Well, it's there are certain practices that we have that we, put in the shower head that, has a little bit more efficient use mm-hmm. of water. What we plant in our yards can be very useful. I love to garden, and I always used to just get rid of the grass because I didn't like cutting grass, but it's also something that you have to water all the time.
Exactly.
So there's beautiful things that you can do in your garden that don't require as much water, And, you know, there's a lot of good solutions to minimizing your use in the first place. That is really where I begin, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Reclaiming water, you know, that you kind of need infrastructure and mm-hmm. things like that to
so
do that.
It's more about conservation, really.
Right. Yeah.
And that starts at home.
It does. And changing just some of our habits. You know, everybody talks about, you know, turn off the water when you brush your teeth. And,
yeah.
But there's, you know, there's lots of really good resources that you can find about minimizing your water use. And I say just start doing one of those and mm-hmm. add one in each month, you know, and new one, so that you start integrating these things into your practice.
Good idea. And if you're on, say, a well, which seems like it's a closed system, it's only you, and if you're getting enough water out of it, is it still important to conserve?
Sure, yeah. You know, you don't know how quickly that is recharged. So, especially during the dry months, you know, during the winter, we have plentiful water and probably a lot of water getting into the system. But if it's not being recharged and replenished, you know, I think some people, definitely in the Southwest, I have friends that live in Arizona, they have had to dig deeper wells.
Mm.
They've had to deepen their wells. And that's because a lot of people are using that same aquifer as, you know, we start getting, you know, more people living on the coast. Your neighbors may be using the same sort of water supplies that you are.
So it's not really that you're, you know, independent of everybody else. We're still very much connected with the underground water system, even if we're drawing from our own well. So even though your well is running really strong all year round, you still may be making things tougher for the neighbors.
Right, depending on your water use. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've got a huge lawn that you water every day. Yeah.
You mentioned gardening. I would assume that maybe native plants are going to be easier on the system because they're already geared for the climate that we have, that they don't need as much additional water. Would that be true?
It depends. In this mm-hmm. part of the world, you know, a lot of the plants have adapted to wetter conditions. And as we move to drier conditions,
right.
You may want to look towards, you know, friendly, drought-tolerant plants, or at least ones that are need less water. But I caution also that, you know, try not to introduce any invasive species into the mix as well, because that can really create a lot of problems in our watersheds.
Really? Like Scotch broom, some of the things we see around here,
sure.
They're a problem?
Up north, it's gorse, and it's mm-hmm. that's kind of moving down south here too.
It sure is.
And those are really, you know, really, once they get established, they're so difficult to manage. So.
And is it just that they're sucking up so much water because that's the kind of plant they are, that they're worse than the native species?
Yeah, and they, you know, they just crowd out a lot of other plants mm-hmm. because they are so dense and stickery and nasty.
I feel the same way about them. Whoever thought that was a good idea to introduce those things? Oh, boy. Anyway, so let's talk about salmon. And I know there's been this whole idea of getting rid of the dams. And mm-hmm. is that because of the salmon? Because I know they put in fish ladders. And here I'm with my dumb questions again. But what is the story with the dams?
Yeah, there was a massive dam building period that started back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, into the 60s, where, you know, there's tens of thousands of dams that were being built every year. And consequently, they saw a plummeting of salmon populations precipitously.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized, well, we need to create fish ladders or things like that. That was during the period of dam building, they realized that the crash in the salmon is where we see the upsurge in hatcheries. So trying to replace what nature has provided for millennia is trying to find a man-made solution to replenishing fish stocks. So build dams, salmon go away, you start getting, you know, hatcheries being built to try to compensate for that. And it's never really, in my mind, been successful.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that there's a movement to actually take dams down.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah, there are certain number of dams being removed every year. Some of it is, yes. Mm-hmm. Some of them, primarily, yes. A lot of these are dams that are no longer used for electrical power, or they're just antiquated, or they're failing, more failing infrastructure. I come from the state of Washington, and one of the more famous dams that was removed was on the Elwha River, which is on the Olympic Peninsula. And it's such a wonderful success story to see that salmon can be so resilient, and that if they're given a chance and the habitat for them to recover, they're able to do so. You just have to give them the right conditions to do so. So the Elwha is a great story about removing a dam and having this salmon population just start to recover.
And there is some issues about salmon being endangered now.
Yes.
And that's affecting us locally.
Yeah, the coho salmon is a threatened species. So we definitely do not want it to get on the endangered list, because that will create a whole bunch of extra layers of regulation that will just be, you know, kind of...
create problems for commercial and pleasure fishing and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it will, you know, dramatically impact, as we know, life as it is now. But right now, coho salmon is a threatened species, and it's our organization, Wild Rivers Land Trust, is working with a number of other partners and stakeholders to try to recover this species and bring it back to its, you know, much higher potential.
What kind of projects are you folks invested in?
Yeah, one of the biggest problems with coho salmon is the loss of habitat. They have a slightly different life cycle, or different types of needs in their life cycle. And I always say that these are kind of the canaries in the coal mines, that when you start to find a species in decline, you look at their loss of habitat, it will probably impact other similar species like Chinook salmon and steelhead, and, you know, a number of other types of fish that will be threatened by the loss of habitat. So a couple of things that coho salmon need are, well, first of all, they need cold water. This is one of the most scary things when we talk about a warming planet and, deforestation around the globe, really is how it affects fish populations. So these fish need cold, clean water to begin with. Our rivers are starting to heat up. There's rising temperatures, especially in the main stem of these rivers on the Oregon coast every year, and it's concerning in my mind, because nothing will kill fish faster than warm water. Second of all, coho salmon need what's called overwintering habitat. This is when we have our tremendous rains during the wintertime. They stay in the river longer than say Chinook salmon do. So they need areas during the wintertime to get out of the high flow areas and into low flow, what we consider kind of
The little eddies and backwaters.
Yeah, backwaters and side streams and side channels and swampy areas and wetland areas that, you know, will become flooded during the wintertime, and they can hang out and not be swept out into the main channel.
And that's being threatened by what, development?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the development as well as just, you know, how we've modified the landscape. There's draining wetlands and, you know, how people will want, you know, channelizing certain types of streams so that they create more dry land for more parts of the year. So some of this is agricultural land. Mm-hmm. So this is where we've lost this habitat and subsequently see a loss in this species. So we're looking for areas that we can kind of reclaim for fish habitat. And really, what's good for coho salmon will also be good for Chinook salmon and steelhead and other types of species that we really, you know, there's a real money and or economic tie to.
And I've seen signs saying, you know, this creek is being reclaimed by so-and-so. What is that the kind of thing that's being done when you see
sure.
a sign like that?
Mm-hmm.
Any other kinds of things that are involved in creek reclamation?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the work that is done is to look for fish passage barriers. These might be, you know, in any number of different types of modifications to water, you know, streams. It may be, you know, a little tiny dam or a culvert, a perched culvert that, you know, just sort of sticks out and water drains out of it, but fish can't get up into it. So these are, you know, some of the types of things, trying to create more wetland areas, and instead of just having a very narrow defined cut channel, trying to get this, you know, to get the stream to meander and create more of a diverse you know, habitat that fish and other species can live in.
Yeah, the estuaries and those kind of wetlands, I think they're really important, not just for the species, but also, don't they have sort of a filtering?
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're, you know, a lot of people try to build bioswales and things like that to capture water coming off of, you know, in cities to, and these wetland areas do help purify water, help slow it down. It can help mitigate flooding. And so it's sort of a giant sponge, you know, that can mm-hmm. be refilled, and so these really serve a number of different services within our
that
our
sounds really important for flood control.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Louisiana is a classic example mm-hmm. of how the Delta has been modified. They've lost a lot of the sort of mangrove and sort of those swampy areas that served as a real buffer for the hurricanes that have come in, and they've lost those areas, and because of that, they see just tremendous flooding and storm surge and other types of problems that they didn't have, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. What other kind of things does the Land Trust get involved in?
Well, broadly, we're interested in bringing more land under conservation management. So we work a lot with partners like soil and water conservation districts and watershed associations. We can provide certain types of services, like we will buy and hold land where a lot of these quasi-governmental, you know, entities do not want to own land. They don't want to hold conservation easements either. So conservation easements are sort of an easement that is, you know, kind of you give up, you know, one of, you can sell or donate this right to, you know, a third party like a land trust or some other type of conservancy group. And you can, you know, have tax benefits from that. But generally, people that are concerned about the creating a legacy for their land and wanting to make sure that their land is managed in a certain way for in perpetuity, really, are interested in putting conservation easements on their property.
So when you put land into a conservation district or something of that nature, what you do, in other words, then the usage is not allowed by humans anymore?
Oh, no.
What happens to the land then in terms of usage?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting process because we don't want to take land out of production or really have it removed from use, if you want to call that. You know, that we work with the landowners to find out what they, first of all, what do they want to achieve with their land? What do they want to protect? What values do they want to protect? And then you can map out areas on the property where they can have, they can do, you know, they can build as many structures as they want in a 5-acre area. And then on the other, you know, 120 acres, they want the forest land managed in such a way, maybe sustainably, or no touch, or they may have agricultural land that they want to remain as agricultural land and not have it be converted to tract housing. So
would something like that then lend itself to ecotourism of some kind, that there might be limited number of buildings put on the land, but the rest of the land developed in such a way that it's basically intact and sustaining those values, but still being, you know, maybe educational or at least, you know, something that people can enjoy?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of up to the landowner, you know, if they want people to have access to their land or not, as like a park or a educational center or a trail system or, you know, any number of different things that could be incorporated into that landscape. A lot of people just want to ensure that their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and future generations can go to that piece of land and it will have the same values that they have always enjoyed. It may be forested. It may still be a place where they want to ranch or farm and not have, not really worry that that's going to go away and be parceled up into small.
Mm. Is that the main thing that the land trust does?
Yeah, we work on conservation easements, but also in purchasing property on the open market conservation purposes. Yeah, that land that has high conservation values.
So, for instance, wetland, so they're not destroyed, things like that.
Right. You know, in holdings in the national forest, you know, that are under threat to be logged and might be a key habitat or have a very critical creek or stream running through it that's important for fish and animal habitat.
And if they did want to, say it's undeveloped land, it's not being used for agriculture or something like that, and they wanted to maybe put nature trails in, is that something that you folks would be able to accomplish for them? Or
I mean, it's you know, we can apply for grants and things like that to first of all you know, establish a conservation easement, but then also, you know, if there are improvements or restoration work, we can apply for grants and have, you know, a riparian buffer, you know, established along creeks. Or we work a lot with the soil and water conservation districts and watershed associations for them to actually do that work. But we would write grants to and contract them to do some of that work if we don't do it ourselves.
So the Soil and Water Conservation District, is that a state agency or?
They're kind of quasi-government agencies, yes. They're established in sort of these water districts, and I'm not so familiar with how they're organized or how they're funded, but some of their funding comes from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, so OWEB, provide some base funding for a lot of these organizations.
Watershed Enhancement Board. And who are they?
They are a government agency.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's state?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So what you do is very impressive, and it's mostly supported by grants?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are there other organizations, if somebody really is interested in finding out more, that you'd recommend that they check in with aside from you folks?
Oh, yeah. You know, if you're interested in doing some type of conservation project on your property, definitely check in with your, like the Curry County Soil and Water Conservation District. They're located in Gold Beach. A great group of people that are doing, you know, really fabulous restoration work of a lot of wetlands and streams and other, you know, areas that are critical for fish and wildlife habitat. And they work with all types of folks, farmers, ranchers, individual homeowners. So they're a very good group to work with. And broadly, they have a group called the Curry Watersheds Partnerships, which is a number of other organizations like the Lower Rogue, folks that they all work together sort of administratively. Mm-hmm. But they all have their kind of specialty areas. So they're located up in Gold Beach. Definitely check in with Matt Swanson and Kelly Timchak and Liesl Coleman and all of them up there to see if that might be of interest to you to do a restoration project. If you're interested in more other types of land conservation, like a conservation easement, that's where the local land trust for the southern coast of Oregon. There's 19 land trusts that operate in the state of Oregon.
Wow.
Some of them work all across the state, like the Wetlands Conservancy and the Nature Conservancy and others. But most land trusts are regionally focused so that you build those relationships with local landowners, and it's a very local, regional activity that even the Nature Conservancy often refers a number of people to us because they get spread pretty thin across the state of Oregon.
All right.
So they look to these regional mm-hmm. land trusts and partners to work
and
with.
And so your area of interest is Wild Rivers, so I assume that's southern coastal Oregon.
Well,
what exactly
we've actually
are your boundaries?
Expanded our area. We now, our service area is from the 10 Mile Lakes region, mm-hmm. North of Coos Bay in North Bend, down to the California border. And we call it sort of the summit to sea stacks, you know, these watershed types of focus that we have. So there's, 13, 14 watersheds in that area. And, you know, it's a lot of different types of rivers are up in the northern part of our service area. Mm-hmm. The Coquille and the Coos watersheds are very different from the Chetco and the Elk River and Pistol River. And the Rogue is, of course, very complex. They have the upper Rogue and then the lower Rogue.
Right.
So, yeah.
So people could contact you.
Yeah.
And is there a website or a
yes.
great place to look to connect up?
Yeah. You can go to our website, which is wildriverslandtrust.org. Or you can give us a call at 541-366-2130. And even if you're not sure where to start with a conservation project, we're glad to kind of talk about alternatives, and we may not be involved ultimately, but our overarching goal for a lot of us and partners that we work with is to work with landowners, find out what they want to do, and try to make that happen for them.
Great. Well, let's be sure and repeat that again at the very end, so
okay.
somebody
right.
needs to get a piece of paper or something,
okay.
they can do
great.
That. But before we get to there, let's talk a little bit about the fire and what that impact has had, because I know that is big top of mind for a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, it's sadly, I think we have to realize that fire has kind of become part of the, I don't know, what happens in this part of the state. I was kind of reviewing how frequently these large fires are happening, and it seems to be on sort of a 12 to 15 year cycle is when we get these really big fires.
And it takes that long to accumulate all the fuel.
Right.
Yeah.
And really that, you know, these winds and the hot, dry summers are just, you know, they're getting hotter and drier. And with the challenges are in, we've had such a legacy of fire suppression for, you know, many, ever. Many years.
Yeah.
And we're starting to encroach. You know, a lot of people are starting to buy their 40 acres up in the woods next, you know, in the bordering the national forest. And these are getting to be, you know, places where they're vulnerable to fire. So I really say that, you know, fire is kind of part of the system here. Yeah, there's ways to manage it. I think that trying to find ways to reduce fuel in our forests is a worthy endeavor, but some of these areas are just, you just can't get to them.
They're inaccessible because of steepness and all of that.
Right. So, you know, this is, it's challenging. It's complex. It's challenging. It's a very difficult thing to get your head wrapped around.
Yeah. And I imagine that in terms of forestry, reforestation, same kind of challenges. So much of that land was just straight up and down.
Yeah, yeah. And that is really what is very unique about, you know, sort of our southern coastal forests is that it's such steep topography. I've been out planting trees in some of the areas that we have property, and it's the areas are so steep. I'm even surprised that there's large trees just growing on these steep slopes because, you know, they're extraordinarily steep, and this creates a lot of problems in these burned areas because you have just increased erosion, and even worse are landslides that develop with time, and you'll have huge amounts of sediment introduced into the river systems because of, you know, the destabilization of those very steep banks.
So even without landslides and such, though, we're getting a lot of sediment in our local systems, I imagine.
Yes, yeah. The whole system is compromised, the Chetco system. So
how bad is it? Can you quantify that in any way?
Well, there are a number of others that are probably doing the monitoring and the sediments of, you know, introduction into these systems. It's a classic example of how you know, you have a burn, there will be a lot of sediment introduced in the system. There are certain things that you can do to at least minimize the amount of sediment that it gets introduced. So I know that, you know, there's a lot of controversy around, you know, the salvage logging proposed in the area.
And what's that about?
Well, a number of these areas have burned, and they would like to remove the logs that have some merchantable timber associated with them. And
being logging companies?
Yes, and the Forest Service as well. They would like to remove these trees quickly because if insects get into them, then the quality of the timber is essentially destroyed within, you know, a year and a half or so. So they would like to you know, go in and do this logging, but that can really be disruptive to the soil. And
it's already so fragile.
It's very fragile to begin with. And then you're in, you know, with logging equipment and dragging logs across the ground and things like that. It really exacerbates the problem. So I know that they're trying to look at ways to do the salvage logging where they would protect some of the riparian zones and possibly not log, do the salvage logging on those very steep slopes, which are even more fragile. So,
well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you know if there are restoration and fuel reduction programs going on or programmed to come?
I don't know of any specifically. I know that they have been proposed. A lot of the very successful programs are actually happening over in the Ashland area. They've done a very good job of developing a program where they're putting people back to work in the forest, doing fuel reduction, controlled burns, and they're really finding great benefits to people and habitat and the health of the forest by instituting these programs. It's a very different type of forest there. It's more of a dry forest, ponderosa pine type
right.
of forest.
Yeah.
But there are certain, translatable, practices that could be instituted here as well that would be very valuable in reducing the amount of fuel that we have in our systems.
Is there any other major effects of the fire that we should be aware of, that you're aware of, even good effects? I mean, it does freshen the habitat for some things, doesn't it?
You start opening up areas that are more conducive to wildlife in general, birds, deer, elk. They have forage that they can will come up in these areas, bears. The thimbleberries and all sorts of edible foods that can come up in these burned areas. So they do have, wildlife benefits as they start to recover. So, yeah, definitely.
Well, it's good to know it's not all bad, considering
right.
what everybody went through.
Yes.
Well, we're just coming to the end of our time here, and why don't you go ahead and tell us again about the best ways to get a hold of you and,
sure.
and get connected?
Yeah, you can look at our website is wildriverslandtrust, all one word, .org. My email address is ann@wildriverslandtrust.org. And our phone number is 541-366-2130.
Well, that's great. And I wanted to thank you for telling us all this good stuff. I feel so much better now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure everybody listening, it really appreciates you too. And we really appreciate you all listening to us. This is Lee Tooley with Ann Schmierer of Wild Rivers Land Trust. And this is Reality Check on KCIW, and thank you so much for listening. 100.7. Thank you.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.